Listen closely. That's not just paint rolling on a wall. It's artistry. A master painter carefully applying Benjamin Moore Regal Select eggshell with deftly executed strokes. The roller, lightly cradled in his hands, applying just the right amount of paint. It's like hearing poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
This episode is brought to you by Vuori. Give the active people in your life something they'll truly appreciate. Performance apparel from Vuori. Whether they're into running, surfing, hiking, or even just casual walks around the block, there's something for everyone. And if you're not sure what to gift them, you can't go wrong with something from Vuori's Dream Knit collection. It's the perfect gift and so comfortable. Get 20% off your first purchase today at Vuori, Vuori.com/Spotify.
Hunger.org.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 9/11 and the War on Terror have put the macho face of the American man back in the world spotlight. Not the Clinton-era I Feel Your Pain brand of boyish charm. Today's magazine cover masculinity is tough, gritty, courageous, loyal. It is often, quite literally, the face of the warrior. War and masculinity have a long and evolving history. Americans know that. So does Al-Qaeda. Tonight on Point, from chivalry to terrorism, war and the changing nature of masculinity. But first, we turn our attention to the skies. Today, for the second time in 2 days, a British Airways flight from London to Washington was canceled for security reasons. On New Year's Eve, the same flight received a jet fighter escort into Washington's Dulles International Airport. Elizabeth Shogren is tracking the air security's ups and downs for the Los Angeles Times. I asked her how forthright officials have been in communicating the reasons for the recent cancellations.
Well, of course, they've been very specific in saying that the reason for this delay is because they have increased concerns that the Al-Qaeda operatives and similar groups like that have a great intention to try to hijack a jet coming from abroad to try to use it as a weapon against America. And they are getting this kind of intelligence information through all their channels. And, of course, they're not telling us exactly what information they're getting or exactly from what group, but they're being specific enough to say that this is why they're making these decisions.
But what have the measures that have been taken indicated about what they know? For example, is the presumption that the threats have been to these particular flights that have been stopped?
Well, I was actually just on the phone with a senior U.S. official with knowledge of this intelligence information and was given great confidence that they have knowledge about these specific flights. That if you notice what's happening, the same British Airways flight has been canceled for a number of days in a row now, and other flights going on the same route by British Airways and other airlines have not been canceled. So what we should derive from this is that, in fact, this very flight is being implicated in the information that they're picking up.
So how many different routes have now seen flights canceled?
Well, we've seen a number of different routes. We've seen it was the route between Paris to LAX. There were several flights that were canceled along that route over the Christmas holiday. And now over the New Year holiday, there have been flights canceled between Mexico City and LAX and between London and Washington. And now another British Airways route, one going to Saudi Arabia, will be canceled on Saturday because of security concerns.
And one of these incoming flights was actually escorted by American jet fighters. Exactly what happened there?
Actually, I think it's probably more than one of them, but the one that you're referring to might be the one that happened on New Year's Eve, and that was the same British Airways flight 223 that we've heard a lot about. And that flight was escorted by jet fighters into its landing at Dulles Airport and then held on the tarmac away from the terminal for a number of hours while passengers were questioned. And the reason is that the flight was en route to Washington when they've decided to intercept the flight.
Are you suggesting, Elizabeth, that more than that flight have been escorted by jet fighters, that many incoming flights or numerous incoming flights are being escorted by U.S. jet fighters at this point?
Yes, it's happened a number of times. I'm afraid that when you're reporting these flights, they get a little bit confused in your head, but I can tell you that there are other instances as well, including into LAX, where there have been fighters that have escorted the jets. Now, what's important to know is that these fighters aren't there to try to harm the passengers anyway. What they're there to do is to give a special extra precaution if something were to happen and the planes were to be hijacked, then the fighters would be right there and ready to intercept.
You say they're not there to harm the passengers, but is one of the reasons they're there not to shoot the plane down if it's headed at some terrible target?
Oh, well, sure, but that would be if that were happening, and so far nothing terrible has happened yet. There is all of this intelligence concern, but no one has been arrested as far as we know, and no suspicious packages have been found. And so far, nothing has happened like that.
Elizabeth, what are officials making of that fact that there have been no arrests? They've canceled these flights. Presumably, they've had access to many of the passengers and the luggage on these flights. In some cases, at Dulles, we know they actually took them off one by one and screened them and went through the baggage. That they apparently have found nothing suggests what?
Well, I'm not sure what exactly it does suggest. I do know that the intelligence officials are quite certain that this threat is very credible, that they don't just willy-nilly suggest that flights should be canceled, that this is a very unusual step to take, and the officials who are making these decisions are quite serious about the threat involved. And I think the other thing that it does reflect is that this is from intelligence analysts who've looked into this question and have been part of these kinds of decisions in this White House and other White Houses, that the other thing that's going on here is that when you have such a serious loss as what happened in September 11th, now security officials know that the consequences can be very dire of not being cautious. And so perhaps they are taking extra precautions, but it's not to suggest that they don't have very credible information.
Is there any sense being given as to how long these cancellations may go on? Could a terrorist organization bring some portion of international air traffic to a halt just by floating threats?
Well, that's actually what one of the security analysts I talked to today suggested, that now terrorists have learned something else, that they have another tool in their toolbox of what to do to terrorize the United States. And, of course, they're always looking for new ways to annoy U.S. officials, and this is the way that they've seemed to be able to do it, by chattering about plans to hijack planes and then having that have the very serious economic impact of having to cancel flights.
But no,
that's not to say that these terrorists have given up the major business, which is to try to commit some kind of terrorist act. That just annoying U.S. officials is not their main goal. And so that's important to remember, that it's not like the boy who cried wolf. This is a much more serious situation.
But no clear view at this point of how long these cancellations may go on.
Well, I've heard different things from different officials, different intelligence officials, so it's a little bit hard for me to say. But one of the things that I was told very clearly is not to sense that just because this is January 2nd that this is all over.
Elizabeth Shogren, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Shogren is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with us from Washington. Firemen and police officers rushing to the rescue on 9/11. President Bush in a Top Gun flight suit, body-armored U.S. forces toughing it out in Iraq. The war on terror has put a new old face on American masculinity, strong, unflinching, courageous, and ready for war. Our guest tonight says that masculinity and war have a long and complex history, whether it's the chivalry of the medieval knight, the death before dishonor ideal of Shakespeare's Hotspur, the modern American soldier in the dust in Baghdad. War pulls out ancient icons of masculinity, elements rooted in history, culture, politics, and myth, the image of the warrior hero, and now, for some, the image of the sworn terrorist. Tonight on Point, masculinity and war. What's your definition of masculinity in 2004? Does it have a little or a lot or nothing to do with war and readiness for war? If one culture insists on linking masculinity and war, must all cultures do the same? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Leo Brody, professor of English at the University of Southern California and author of From Chivalry to Terrorism, The Changing Nature of Masculinity. Good evening and welcome, Leo Brody.
Thanks very much, Tom.
It's great to have you. You open your book quoting the great Roman poet Virgil. Right at the top of his epic poem of the founding of Rome, he writes, "I sing of arms and the man, the connection is pretty old, but you're saying, Leo Brody, it's not genetic, as has been sometimes suggested.
No, I don't think so. In fact, masculinity is always something to be striven for. And if you look at tribal initiations, it's always something that has to be done in order to be a man. I mean, this is the idea that men are somehow made, but women are born, in fact. You can always tell. A woman has her femininity. A man has to keep striving for his masculinity.
But you say that in everything that's going on today, particularly around conflict, there are ancient underground streams of understanding of what masculinity is, what it can be, what it ought to be, that are kind of interacting, form an interplay with what's in front of us right now. Give us a little history lesson. This is a big book with a lot of fabulous detail, and I have to say I really enjoyed it, Leo Brody.
Thank you.
Give us a thumbnail. We don't have forever. Give us a thumbnail
right,
sketch
sure.
of those kind of fundamental streams of masculinity intertwined with war. How inevitable is that? How separable is that?
Well, it's certainly distinguishable. I mean, when you look back in a tribal situation where virtually every man, every able-bodied man has to fight if the tribe is being threatened or if the tribe wants to threaten somebody else, there's a kind of coincidence between masculinity in general and specifically the masculinity of the military masculinity, the masculinity of violence. Mm-hmm. There you are fighting for the tribe. But then as you get more complicated political organizations, the fighting side of masculinity is given to a certain group, the knights, let's say, in the Middle Ages. But still it remains a kind of ideal for other men. But as civilization gets even more and more complicated, then other kinds of masculinity come in here. The masculinity of the athlete, of the orator, of the saint, of the artist, of the performer, the scientist, the thinker, as kind of competitors with military masculinity. But one thing that happens is that whenever war threatens, there's a kind of reversion almost to that kind of uniform masculinity, uniform in both senses, of course. That is the acme of masculinity. So if you're pro-war or if you're anti-war, in fact, masculinity and war are intertwined concepts. Either war is the crown of masculinity or else war is the gravest charge against it.
And you write, all questions, all ambiguities, all contradictions in what it means to be a man or a citizen are banished in the creation of the warrior. We want to get back into a number of these streams in more depth, but give us your basic take on what's going on right now in terms of current world conflict and masculinity. You're making some pretty large observations here. One of them is, you say, that the attacks on the World Trade Center in 2001, you describe the attack made in the name of an exclusionary masculine culture against what it considers to be, as did the fascists, an emasculated mercantile culture. Are you saying that Islamist fundamentalists see the West as having drifted away from the link of manhood and warrior masculinity and warrior status, and that's what they're charging at?
Well, that's certainly, if you read the statements of bin Laden about why he's attacking the West and what's going on and what his attitude towards the West is, that's very central to them. That is, this kind of fundamentalist culture that focuses on the warrior sensibility as the prime way of being a man also emphasizes the absolute difference between men and women. And that the feminine in any form, not just in terms of women, but in terms of commercial civilization, goods, things like that, that's what undermines that true warrior spirit. And one of the differences that I point out there is that, in fact, in that kind of warrior culture, or I suppose I should call it neo-warrior culture because they're trying to go back to the 7th century there, in that kind of culture, male and female are absolutely different. Whereas with the problem with the West is that, in fact, male and female are on a continuum of gender behavior there, and this is another source of the attack.
So you're describing terrorism as one of your chapter heads is terrorism is a kind of gender war. That is an effort to reassert an absolute distinction between genders.
Yes, an absolute distinction. You know, exactly right. That it's an absolute distinction between genders, but it's because, I mean, the bottom of it is that, in fact, you need that absolute distinction for men to be truly men. Because if you let the feminine in at any point, whether the feminine, as I said, is real as real women, or whether the feminine is a kind of relaxation of standards or a desire to, you know, to be comfortable or anything like that, you will undermine the true masculinity, which is at the heart of things.
So what are you suggesting here, Leo Brody, that the West invited this attack by drifting away from a more macho, warrior-oriented masculinity, or that an evolving West is now confronted with a throwback masculinity or something else?
Well, I think it's more the latter. It's that the West has evolved in certain – not that these ideas weren't present in the West. You look in the 18th
Lord,
and 19th
no.
century. Yeah, I mean, those kind of ideas are there. People in the 18th century were saying at the beginnings of commercial civilization, were saying that, look, all these luxury goods are making us unvirile as a country, people in England, people in France. But I think it's really what the latter part of what you said, that is, in fact, civilization has evolved. Western civilization has gone through some of these changes and worked out some of these ideas. But there's a throwback here, and it's a throwback. It's not unlike the throwback, let's say, of Nazism or of fascism or of the Japanese militarists in the 1920s and 30s before World War II. They all wanted to go back to a prior world, a prior warrior world where men were really men and women stayed in their place.
Leo Brody, hold the thought. This is very rich
sure.
stuff. We're eager to dig in and grateful that you're with us tonight. Leo Brody is author of the new book, From Chivalry to Terrorism, War and the Changing Nature of Masculinity. You can join the conversation. Are masculinity and war readiness innately connected in your mind? Do you like that? Do you want them connected or not? And what's your definition of masculinity in 2004? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the changing face of masculinity in war and in terrorism. My guest is Leo Brody. He's joining us from Los Angeles. He's professor of English at the University of Southern California and author of the really terrific new book, From Chivalry to Terrorism, War and the Changing Nature of Masculinity. You can join our conversation tonight. Are masculinity and war readiness innately connected in your mind or not? And what's your definition of masculinity in 2004? Is it Arnold Schwarzenegger running California or metrosexuals in New York or U.S. soldiers in Iraq? Is American culture still trapped in old masculine stereotypes? Is Islamic culture? Is everyone? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Leo Brody, is it possible? You say it's almost impossible to talk about a history of masculinity because it's so diverse. But is it possible to talk about common characteristics of masculinity, or is even that too broad?
Well, I can't say that it's too hard to talk about a history of masculinity since that's what I tried to do in the book. But it's true. It's so complicated and there's so many different factors in it that I had to isolate some important factors. And one of those factors was the history of technology as well. That is, if war is a place where men gain honor, and that's why it is a crown of masculinity. Mm-hmm. What happens when technology makes that kind of face-to-face engagement, which is the true way to gain honor, makes it almost irrelevant when you have people bombing troops that they can't even see, when you have guns that can fire many hundreds of yards? I mean, this is sort of what happened really for the first, not quite for the first time, but certainly with the greatest impact in World War I. People were being killed by people they didn't see.
Though you describe it wonderfully, even in the Hundred Years' War, where the French knights who were so in love with their shining armor continued to sally forth on the great war horses, even when the English longbows were mowing them down. They didn't want to accept that there was a new kind of equation on the battlefield because their masculinity was tied up in a certain expression of warrior qualities.
Absolutely. Their masculinity and their honor. That is, there's often a conflict there between what would be a practical strategy in a war situation and an idea of honor, because the practical is seen frequently as dishonorable. In fact, and that's why there's a great deal of nostalgia in all warfare. And the nostalgia is really for the honor of the past and the effort to kind of keep it going in the present.
And yet, terrorism as warfare makes it very personal once again. We saw the faces of all or most of those 19 terrorists on September 11th. We know their names, Mohammed Atta. These are not invisible warriors. In death, they became very visible.
Well, and that's part of that desire to go back to a time when there was true honor in warfare and when people did it individually somehow, and that they weren't part of an anonymous mass machine. They weren't in uniforms. They were each going out to fight for what they believed in. Though it's true, there's a kind of very deep nostalgia there in that kind of militant Islamic fundamentalism.
So what then have you seen in the American response to that affront? How have you seen masculinity
played out there. You write that wartime masculinity is a top-down and bottom-up effort to emphasize a code of masculine behavior more single-minded and more traditional than the wide array of circumstances and personal nature that influences the behavior of men in non-war situations. Have you seen that kick in the United States post 9/11?
Not very much, I think. And one of the reasons is, I think, that in fact, what was stressed after 9/11 was united we stand. It was about the country coming together there. And whereas, in fact, our army is an intriguingly different army, let's say, than the army that fought World War II. It is not an army that draws from every level of society. So you can't say that it's really a mirror of society. It's an army of many people, and this is another function of warfare through the ages, who want to better themselves by going to war, who want to better their education, better the lot of their families. To a certain extent, there's a kind of, without using it negatively, there's a mercenary side to this army. That is, it's a professional army. It's not a volunteer. There are volunteers in it, of course, but it's really about professionalism. So I wonder if, in fact, we're sort of making our army, you know, like the barriers, let's say, that the army formed in the Middle Ages almost, where the rest of society sort of takes place on the other side.
Although when Time magazine's Person of the Year cover is three uniformed men, and I think how they phrase it, the American soldier, doesn't that have a cultural ripple that's wider than the professional military?
It does, because it's trying to evoke the idea of, in fact, these people, you know, being our sons, that these are people who that we can identify with. These are people who could be part of our own family. So there has to be some connection. I mean, one of the I once asked General Schwarzkopf, you know, what the Army had learned from Vietnam. And he said never to engage in a war that didn't have civilian support. Mm-hmm. So how do you make that civilian support work there? Well, one way is to say we are connected to the soldiers. They're not just out there doing our dirty work for us, but they are one of us, two of us, three of us.
Okay, so here's where it gets down to the nub. You write, and my reading of the whole book is that the kind of one bottom line takeaway is, and you write specifically that Europe and the United States you see or saw as in the aftermath of a period of lots of war and masculinity built on war in the 20th century and 19th century, moving, in your words, decisively towards seeing human nature as a larger and more complex whole in which judgments about individuals need not be based on their sexuality and so on, certainly not necessarily on their warrior masculinity. You saw that as taking place. I read you as seeing the terrorism threat as interrupting that evolution. Is it as simple as that?
Well, no, it's not. It's obviously more complicated, but in a sense, what terrorism represents in this way is a threat that says, you know, you have evolved. If evolved, the terrorists don't think of it as evolution. They think of it as degeneracy. Mm-hmm. In fact, you have degenerated from an old warrior society into this kind of amorphous commercial society in which you can't tell the difference between the sexes. And there are no true men. And we're going to take you to task for that. And we're going to defeat you on that basis. But again, this is exactly the same kind of thing that Hitler said about the United States and about Britain. We were too democratic. We would never fight. We were weak. We were sybaritic. And look what happened.
But if you imagine that America and Europe, as you describe them, have been engaged in establishing some new kind of beachhead where masculinity is more free from the warrior iconography, the warrior culture, then what does American behavior post 9/11 say to you? I mean, as I read you, I found myself thinking, well, maybe this is what the U.S.-Euro split is about, that Europe is determined not to step back into those boots of the warrior and saw the United States, particularly the person of George Bush, as very ready to get the cowboy boots, the warrior boots, back on.
Well, I think, but also the conduct of the war and how we should have gone to war and whether we were prepared to go to war, not only for the war itself, but for the aftermath and the reconstruction, I think is still a source of controversy here, too. So I think we're having kinds of internal battles at the same time that we want to show a solid front to the enemy. The problem now, though, is that the enemy is much more elusive than the enemy used to be. It used to be that the enemy was on the other side of the battle line and we were on our side, and the enemy wore a red uniform and we wore a blue uniform, whatever it was, the distinctions were clear. But with this particular enemy, the enemy is much more pervasive. The enemy could be behind us. In my chapter on Vietnam, I call it war without a front. And I think that's really where it begins, this idea of clarity. It used to be clarity in war, us versus them. Well, it's still us versus them, but we don't know where them is or who them are often.
Though what struck me even more was your ambivalence about warrior masculinity. We were talking this afternoon, I was talking with my staff, with women on my staff, and their response was very interesting. They said, well, look, if masculinity is not rooted in warrior culture, then who's going to defend us when the chips are down, when times get tough, if it's not about the war man at bottom at some level, then what is masculinity about? I was surprised at this response, but it was very immediate.
Well, that's interesting, and I think one way is to get at that is to say, is masculinity the same as men? Is masculinity a kind of human trait that we want to decouple from a gender distinction? Masculinity can be about honor. It can be about integrity. It can be about courage and willingness to fight. Are these characteristics only of men?
So what are you saying? You want to share the burden? That's the answer here? Have women put on armor too, or move beyond that?
Well, move beyond it. We've done it to a great extent, but we're also moving beyond it as well. That is, one of the great controversies too, and it's an intriguing take on this. Say within the services, starting with the 1920s, is to what extent technology is really the way to win a war, and to what extent it means that you have to be on the ground, that you have to grapple directly with the enemy,
and exhibit old-fashioned heroism, manliness, masculinity.
Manliness, masculinity, that kind of solidity that we're used to in our warriors. And once again, I think that because of the way this war has been defined, it is a war against terrorism, it's a war against this kind of amorphous entity, that one of our problems, I think, in fighting this war is that we go back to these old models. We go back to, let's go find Hussein, let's go find bin Laden, let's go find a country that we can attack, when in fact the greater threat comes from countries from within countries that we couldn't attack.
So the old macho response and maybe not the evolving response, but then who knows? Listeners, we're going to turn to you right now. There are a lot of people waiting to come on. We're talking with Leo Brody. He's the author of the new From Chivalry to Terrorism, War and the Changing Nature of Masculinity. Are we still surrounded by closet he-men, gladiators, wild warriors, and knights in shining armor? Is that a comfort or a curse? We're at 1-800-423-8255. David's calling from Boston. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. My comment that I want to make is that I believe that war and that masculinity is associated with going out and doing kind of everything, because traditionally men have been in like a control position because females have been subservient in society.
So chop the wood, rule the town, make the war.
Yeah, and there are some metaphors for like the physicality of being a man in like ancient tools of war, as far as like, you know, projectiles and swords, what have you. But now that we have the technology and it's button pushing and trigger pulling and of course strategy, which is the main component, I think that females are every bit as capable of these things, and it's just identified with masculinity because men have been in the role to do it. And furthermore, what I want to say is that it's a shame that in our culture, women are in a position where they have to become more like men. Maybe it would be better off if men became more like women.
So are you saying, David, you'd rather keep the masculinity, the maleness and war tie than spread it around?
Well, no, I would rather not have the war at all. I mean, I'm a pacifist.
Mm-hmm. David, thanks for your call. Leo Brody, is there a way out of this? If you're saying this is not genetically coded in men, is there then a way out? Can men be self-respecting in the way that masculinity is described and still survive when other societies or other men are defining masculinity as warlike, war readiness?
Well, I think there's scope. There's an area for all different kinds of masculinity. That's the thing. It's a more multiplicitous situation. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that's happened in the history of civilization is that, in fact, the physicality that the caller was talking about has become less and less relevant as a way of doing almost anything, certainly as a way of waging war. The physicality that was required by both the knights in armor and the archers to pull that bow back, when gunpowder came in, that became almost irrelevant there. Anybody, you didn't have to be very strong to pull a trigger. And technology, as technology has advanced, the need for that old style male physicality, that kind of dual physicality where you just it's one on one, mano a mano, became less and less relevant.
So anybody can press the button, but then that still leaves the question of whether masculinity itself is a kind of a prod toward. Nick is calling from Boston. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hi. First of all, I want to say thank you to Professor Brody for writing this book. I wrote my senior thesis on masculinity, and I think it's an area that needs more academic study.
Thank you.
My question for you is that I wrote on Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. and his relationship with his father and how his father sent him towards war was part of the reason he went. And after completing it, I saw the movie Fight Club, and I caught the line, "We're a generation of men raised by women." And it got me thinking whether or not one of the reasons we have these sort of cycles of violence and war comes up is that people see their fathers or their grandfathers go off to war. They hear the stories of what real men are. And then they need to find their opportunity to make those expressions. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that, Professor Brody.
Sure. I mean, that's, again, that kind of nostalgia and that kind of staging of masculinity. You know, I want to be the man that my father or my grandfather was, but I don't have the scope for it. I mean, it's intriguing. At the beginning of the 20th century, William James wrote an essay called The Moral Equivalent of War, just around the time, you know, when Holmes was there at Harvard, and people were talking still in the shadow of the Civil War. They hadn't gotten to World War I yet. And what James meant by the moral equivalent of war is that war created all this energy. Can't we use it somewhere else? Can't we turn it into other areas and not have to actually kill people?
And do we have an answer to that yet?
Well, I think that's something that was behind the Peace Corps. That was behind the war on poverty and other kinds of metaphors of war that were used, let's say, in the 60s, but to attack social problems in one way or another. We have this energy. There's this pool of energy. People want to do something, but is it really killing people that they want to do, or is it they want to change the world? And if it's that they want to change the world, it's not just aimless violence. Let's point it in a good direction.
And yet when the shooting starts, all heads or many heads still seem to turn awfully quickly. Nick, thanks for your call. Carla's calling from Boscobel, Wisconsin. Hi, Carla. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My reading of traditional warrior culture and mythology, there were women warriors who were celebrated. Brunhilde in the Norse mythology and Bradamante in the legends of Charlemagne. And these men were not at all threatened by these women. They were happy to have someone else in battle. And these were pretty macho guys. So I don't think being a female is necessarily an impediment. And I don't understand your thesis that this return to masculinity is necessarily anti-women, or to be a warrior you need to be against women.
Leo Brody?
Well, I think, you know, the difference is whether you're being a woman or whether you're being a woman who is male identified. And all these female warriors are women who are in the mold of men, just as there are a lot of religious people who became warriors in the same way. A lot of priests, you know, think about Friar Tuck or somebody like that. That is, they're brought up in a religion that supposedly is about the meek and about turning the other cheek. But in fact, they turn into warriors. I mean, it's intriguing. Just around the time of Joan of Arc, there was a writer named Christine de Pizan who wrote about the fact that women could be warriors. I mean, she went into this whole thing. She wanted women to have a kind of claim on the honor of warrior masculinity. But at the same time, she said that, in fact, women had this other side to them as well. And so there became two sets of female heroes. One were the female warriors, like Boadicea and Joan of Arc herself and people like that. And the other was the line of female saints. So I think it's a little more complicated. You think about the female suicide bombers. That is the fact that a female has become a suicide bomber in this situation going to change at all the status of women in the society that they come from? Probably not. So are they really women in that sense?
Carla, we just have a few seconds here, but do you then want to see the war-making shared or the war-making stopped?
I don't. As long as there are bullies, there's a need for warriors. It's a necessary evil. But as long as you're going to need to be a warrior, you might as well be a good one.
Whatever your gender. Carla, thanks very much for your call. We've got to take a short break. Leo Brody, please stand by. We're talking with Leo Brody, author of From Chivalry to Terrorism, War and the Changing Nature of Masculinity. You can join our conversation tonight. Can you picture a new definition of masculinity untethered to war? And what would it look like? Would it be metrosexual, Dr. Phil, Dennis Kucinich, David Beckham. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the changing face of masculinity in war and terrorism with Leo Brody. His new book is From Chivalry to Terrorism, War and the Changing Nature of Masculinity. You can join the conversation. Are masculinity and war readiness innately connected in your mind or not? What's your definition of masculinity in 2004? And if Osama bin Laden calls American men wusses, and trust me, he does, are American men obliged to push back with warlike masculinity? Or is there another way? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Nick is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing tonight?
Great. Thanks, Nick.
Hey, outstanding topic. Jess is bringing up some good points. I just wanted to let you both know that I don't know if it falls under masculinity directly, but the warrior ethic and the warrior code are still alive and very strong in certain parts of the United States.
What do you mean? What are you referring to exactly, Nick?
Most definitely the United States Marine Corps that I'm a part of. We are taught basically the code of chivalry, and we are taught compassion, but we are also trained to be able to have the ability to carry out violent acts when they're needed. And ironically, the two, the thoughts of chivalry and compassion and the ability to carry out that violence, go hand in hand.
So, Nick, you're in the Marine Corps active duty now?
That's correct.
Leo Brody, I'd love to hear you and Nick go back and forth a little bit. What's your question, Leo, to Nick on how he defines masculinity, warrior culture? Here's the contemporary American warrior.
Well, he said it himself there. I mean, that's that relationship between compassion for the weak, compassion for those who aren't fighting, along with violence when you are being attacked. And this really is part of the old chivalric ethic, certainly in the West. Now, if you look at the history of the samurai, there was never that compassionate side. They were just purely violent in that way, and they were protecting members of a certain class, and it was very male-oriented. Mm. But in the West, somehow it grew up that women had to be protected, that the weak had to be protected, and that's more a part of our tradition.
Nick, let me ask you, you're part then of this professional American Army. Do you see your warrior ethic side as connected to your profession or to your masculinity?
I would most definitely say it's connected to both, but it is definitely something we are trained on.
Yeah, we hear it loud and clear. Nick, thanks very much for your call. Leo, I wish you'd take us back through a little bit of this evolution of the changes that have taken place in masculinity over time in relation to the warrior, war, the war face. You say that that's not been a steady state definition. If you go all the way back to the ancients, right on to contemporary warfare, there's an evolution that goes, that ebbs and flows in what it means to be masculine and warlike.
Yes, absolutely. There's a change there, and it really depends on a lot of different factors. And some of the major factors are what kind of political system this masculinity and this warfare appear in. If you're in something like the Greek city-state or the smaller world of the Middle Ages, where it was all very local and one little lord was fighting another little lord and there weren't countries per se, it's one kind of masculinity. It's much more immediate, much more direct. And it's also very class-oriented because it's the people who had the money to buy the armor and the people who had the money to buy the horses and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, then you move on to the centralized states of France and England and Spain there in the 16th and 17th century, and you're getting another idea of masculinity because you have a king at the top who's telling people what to do. Mm-hmm. That kind of locality has disappeared. The state takes on the idea of giving honor itself.
So, and loyalty to that king becomes a big part of...
Loyalty to the king. In fact, loyalty to the king supersedes loyalty to the local lord. And this is actually, there's a lot of fights about this, but that's what finally emerges. So the centralized state changes things too. Then there's another change when the idea of citizenship comes in. In a monarchical state, you're a subject. You do what the king says you should do. But then when you become a citizen, you can vote about it. The French and American revolutions at the end of the 18th century, the idea of the country in arms, the citizens in arms, you know, aux armes citoyens, you know, in the Marseillaise.
And how does that change the sense of masculinity, what it means to be masculine?
Well, it kind of resuffuses the society. Before that, it's really much more local and connected to to mercenary groups. I mean, it's intriguing, say, up until the time of the American and French Revolution, most wars are fought by mercenaries.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the Dutch, who prided themselves at the beginning of the 17th century in being a republic and bringing citizens into that, that Dutch army was probably not more than 20% real Dutchmen.
So there were warriors and non-warriors with a clear line.
Mm-hmm. And they were hired, too. I mean, even the word soldier comes from a word meaning money. So, I mean, there's all sorts of financial sides to this. And so, of course, the people who had the most soldiers were the people who had the money to hire them as well. And there's an old saying that, who wins the war? The one who has the last dollar, essentially.
I was struck by all the connections between language and war and masculinity. Even weapon you describe as somehow coming down from with penis.
Yes, weapon is connected. It's a word in Old English that's also used to describe male plants and things like that. So it's definitely connected to, to sexual parts.
Jessica's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Jessica. You're on the air.
Hi. You were talking before about you were asking the question of, the modern male masculinity.
Yeah.
And in my opinion, I'm in my mid-20s, and what I've seen, I think men have become less masculine and seem to be... I don't know if it's like the women's movement, and they have many of the traditional male roles have been taken away from them,
mm-hmm.
and overcompensating with aggressiveness against each other, because that's what it seems to me. It seems that there's a lot of obsession with even like sports and with
sports, bodybuilding, all the kind of drama movie epics built around Rambo and all that. You're onto something that Leo Brody's written about there. Jessica, let me ask you, as you observe that, what you describe as less masculine men, how do you feel? What's your response to that? Do you welcome it? Are you sorry for it? What's your response?
I think it's sad because it seems to be more. It seems to be that they're. Insecure mm-hmm. now, with they feel like women are kind of taking over. I mean, this is just what it seems like to me, that they might feel that women are taking over and they're not needed as much in the protector world, and so they're
a little lost,
maybe. Yeah,
Jessica, it's a great point, and I'm glad you raised it. Thanks for calling with that. Leo Brody, you've written about exactly what you and others have called the crisis of masculinity in the late 20th century. How does that fit into Jessica's observation?
Well, with this, whether you can say, in fact, there have been crises going on throughout the 20th century, maybe even into the 19th century, and the crisis always comes at a time when, in fact, an older idea of masculinity seems irrelevant to a present situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so that people try to compensate in one way or another. And that older ideal is often a kind of reductive ideal of the tough guy or the manly man who does this kind of work and the woman does another kind of work. And I think right now we're in a time of ferment. I mean, this is another way of looking at crisis. That's a crisis of an old masculinity, of an old gender, division of gender roles.
But and there you're talking Islamic, Islam-based, Islamist executed.
Mm-hmm. But it's also an opportunity. It's an opportunity for change. It's an opportunity for getting away from this kind of simplified view of what men do and what women do.
What do you mean by that? Are you saying, bravo, George Bush, get into Afghanistan, get into Iraq and remake everything, remake gender roles?
Well, no, he can't do that particularly, but what he can do is bring a kind of a more open society there and let them do what they can do with it and change. I mean, in fact, the fundamentalists, I think, are a fairly small segment of these societies, but they're also, very publicized, and they're trying to become more public, creating these symbolic acts of violence and things like that.
But let me
ask
you about Jessica's point there. She observes men as they moved away from that traditional, maybe more warrior-oriented, masculinity-oriented, becoming unmoored, a little lost. Is there another powerful iconography, another powerful framework waiting or soon to be built or ready for men to grab onto to feel masculine?
Well, I think it's part she's talking about people in their 20s, and I think that's a very particular area of, masculine society as it is of feminine society. It's a time when people are just not quite sure what it means to be grown up, what it's not – their own identities are in flux in one way or another, and they're poised there, waiting there. Now, I just remember from, being that age myself, you always think that there's some prophet is going to appear and say, do this or do that. You're always waiting for some – some line to pop up and give you the word. But in fact, what happens is that you evolve yourself and you create your own self through kinds of relationships, through things that you do.
Yeah, well, but maybe it's about the 20s. But you write yourself. Yeah. You say, are there any masculine myths suitable for a settled or global world, or are men mm-hmm. doomed to feel insufficient in the face of modernity? You say, after a millennium and more of metamorphosis, are the old myths on the verge of a final collapse as men struggle toward some new synthesis? But you raise the question, you know, is there another myth?
Well, this is the question. Is there another myth? Is there a myth of a kind of masculinity that doesn't have to exhibit itself in violence, that doesn't have to prove itself in aggressive behavior? I think, you know, we are looking for whether we found it or not. And, you know, we, at times, like, the problem with looking for myths is that usually you go back to some older myth that, in fact, is outworn. The question is, can we create some new myths, some new, more positive myths? And I don't have the answer to that. I'm more a historian than a futurologist in this. And that's what I think we're looking for. We're desperately looking for. You know, after September 11th, I thought the administration was responding in an intriguing way, that it wasn't this kind of shooting from the hip thing, at least for the first 6 weeks or couple months. It was more like what I would describe as the Alan Ladd way of doing things, not the John Wayne way.
That is
Alan, you know, that you have to push me. Yeah, you talking to me? You pushing me? You know, you don't immediately respond there. Alan Ladd and Shane, you know, you don't mm-hmm. immediately respond. And why don't you immediately respond? Because self-control gives you the moral high ground.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you don't respond. And so, you know, that previous caller who was talking about chivalry and violence mm-hmm. and sympathy there, I mean, what is the new amalgam of those things that perhaps we can fashion a new myth from?
But that "are you talking to me" moment tends not to last forever. And by golly, when it's over, the lead can really fly. Peter's calling from Medford, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
How are you doing, Tom?
Great.
Listen,
thanks.
Great show. I just caught the last 15 minutes or so, but I preface my remarks. I'm a Vietnam combat veteran, infantry veteran.
Mm-hmm.
And first thing I'd say is thank God we have warriors. Still, the Marine Corps puts out some warriors out there. And I think, I'm not one of these to tell the troops to go in for unnecessary wars, et cetera. But
yep.
I think the professor, a couple of things. Quickly, I could tell he's never been in combat.
Why?
First thing to say that you don't physically, the most demanding, and I'm at 55, I still work out, and I play college football, high school football,
okay.
and work it out. To think that you don't need to be, it's the most physically grueling life experience you've ever had to be in combat as an infantryman, carrying 80 pounds worth of gear.
But Peter, wouldn't you grant that a greater and greater percentage has moved to the push button, to the AWACS, to the cruise missile targeter?
I would say our 300 casualties in Iraq so far are certainly not as a result of technical things. It's patrolling, it's getting ambushed, it's grunting.
Yeah, there's still plenty of people right there. That's right.
And since time immemorial, thank God you have warriors, and the Marine Corps still pushes them out. That at least we have. I agree. This younger generation, and I think that unfortunately reflected by, you know, some of the attitudes, think that somebody's going to fight for them.
So you're saying it's still got to be men out there. And Peter, I'm going to take it with that because I've got one more call I want to get. But we've got your point, and I'm sure Leo Brody would agree at some degree. I want to get one more
sure.
call. Steve from Burlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hello. My brother served in Afghanistan along with my father together, and I'm going to the Peace Corps very soon. And I just thought it was interesting and the way that my family treats me, pretty much the same way as my brother and my father.
So you get as much honor, you get as much respect as a person, as a man with the Peace Corps choice?
For the most part, I'd say about 99%, yes, I do.
And do you ever wonder, Steve, am I as manly as my brother and father in Afghanistan because you're going the Peace Corps path?
Nope, my family's been very supportive, so this is just something that I appreciate a lot from my family. I think I'm lucky, though, and I do understand your point.
I'm sure you do appreciate that, and we're glad to hear it. Steve, thanks for your call. Leo Broder, our time is growing short. One of the big questions you ask at the end of the book is, you say, is the most recent form of terrorism thus the last gasp of a militant warrior personality type that has survived the centuries? Can you begin to answer that?
Well, I think that's my optimistic side. I just wonder if this is really the end of the old warrior tradition, because it's been ransacked so much. It was the Germanic tribes were ransacked by Hitler. The Roman Republic was ransacked by Mussolini. The samurai was ransacked by the Japanese militarists. And now the early years of Islam are being ransacked by Al-Qaeda.
When you say that early Islam is being ransacked, you mean they're going back to draw on those old images, icons, mythologies?
Specifically the warrior image. Let's go back to that old purity. Let's go back to that old kind of aggressiveness and violence. Let's cut away civilization. Let's clean all the rust of civilization off of us and go back to that self.
Wow. A lot of history. It's hard to imagine somehow shaking entirely free of it. But maybe it's the last gasp, as you suggest. Leo Brody, it's been great talking with you tonight. Thanks for the book, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Leo Brody, professor of English at the University of Southern California, author of From Chivalry to Terrorism, War and the Changing Nature of Masculinity. There is a lot in there. Get it. You'll enjoy it. You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.